Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. Today we're joined by the author of Manifest Destinies, UNM Professor Laura Gomez. Her book looks at the current position of Mexican Americans in the U.S. and in New Mexico, and then details the history of how we got here. Laura Gomez, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
Laura, I'd like to start with two recent events. On the one hand, I think we all suffered through an incredibly negative tone to the immigration debate, particularly toward Mexicans and Mexican Americans. And on the other hand, we witnessed Governor Bill Richardson, a fairly successful run for president. He trumpeted his Mexican roots. He did pretty well in states with very low Mexican American and Hispanic populations. Can you kind of help us understand those contradictions?
Yes, yeah, sort of different trends there, right?
Yes.
I mean, I think on the one hand, Richardson's run for the presidency, the first time that we've had a Hispanic running for the major party nomination, and as you said, he did fairly well for himself. He did certainly respectably.
Much better than Joe Biden.
That's right. That's right. Is reflective of the demographics that we are seeing today and that we're going to see more of. Hispanics are now 15% of the U.S. population, and they're projected to be 30% by 2050. So 2050. So we're going to be seeing more of that kind of political muscle on the national stage. We've always seen a lot of it in New Mexico, but we're going to be seeing more on the national stage. And at the same time, against that backdrop is really the fact that especially since 9/11, I think that the immigration debate has really turned very negative, very xenophobic, and as you said, sort of with the assumption that being that all Latino immigrants are Mexican and are undocumented. And that's really, really paralleling a cycle of responses to immigrants, Mexican immigrants, but also Chinese immigrants in the 1880s and so on. So we've seen this in American history before, but we're definitely in a period right now where there's pretty intense xenophobia, I think, on the part of the rhetoric of that debate.
Well, one of the things that your book does is describe Mexican Americans as, quote, off-white, as opposed to white or something else, and say that to really understand the position of Mexican Americans, we need to go back to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And all our Spanish listeners, please forgive my pronunciation, to understand the position of Mexican Americans. So what is it about that treaty that helps us understand the history of Mexican Americans in this country?
Well, it's really, if you could think of that, and I think we should think about that treaty, which was the peace treaty that ended the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848, is that's the sort of the document that created Mexican Americans as a people, because under that treaty, 115,000 Mexicans who were living in the vast territory that Mexico was forced to cede as a concession to the United States to end the war, were given federal U.S. citizenship. And so, you know, from one night to the other, those people became Mexican Americans. They were Mexicans the day before, but after that treaty, they became Mexican Americans. They weren't immigrants to the United States, right? You know, the famous saying.
They were the original inhabitants.
Right, right. We didn't cross the border crossed us, applied to those 115,000 people. And if we think about we think about those people and the tremendous kind of, what the book is really about is what happens when this changes overnight? Well, overnight, things don't change all that much in people's lives, and yet people begin to realize that they're in a different political and social environment.
One of the things about the treaty is that the United States is the victor. It's occupying Mexico City. Seemingly, it could dictate any terms it wants. It's got this pretty virulent racist philosophy that if you're not white, you're nothing. You're a slave, basically. It's sort of a binary concept. Mm-hmm. And yet the United States, I guess, puts forth terms that permit Mexican and Americans and Indians, seemingly, because any Mexican citizen could become a U.S. citizen, to become a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. So is that and you see that in terms of, say, racism continuing for the next 100 years in the United States. In South Africa, continues to 1990, open racist policies. Mm-hmm. How do you see that treaty in terms of permitting Mexicans and Indians to become U.S. citizens.
You know, I think you're right to acknowledge that it was generous in some ways, right? That grant of federal citizenship was in many senses very magnanimous of the victors of the war, right? On the part of the victors, but at the same time, I think in the context, looking at mid 19th century as opposed to 21st century right now, federal citizenship at that time was a lot less valuable in terms of a guarantor of one's rights than state citizenship. So, and this was not the case in Mexico. Mexico was also a republic, but in Mexico, federal citizenship mattered, not, say, whether you were a citizen of Jalisco or Guanajuato or various states in Mexico. But in the United States, it mattered if you were a citizen of Virginia or a citizen of Maryland, not that you were a federal citizenship. Your political rights came from that state citizenship.
So in some ways, it was kind of empty.
That's right. It sort of was we're giving you a little bit, but you know, we're not giving you that much.
And aside from this legal status, you write that there was the actual status, the way Mexican Americans were viewed, was unbelievably racist.
Right. One of the themes of Manifest Destinies is that there's this tension or contradiction between, on the one hand, the legal position of Mexican Americans having limited political rights because they had that federal citizenship, and then certain rights in New Mexico, in particular Mexican American men in New Mexico had rights to vote and serve in the territorial legislature, for example. But what I'm trying to show in the book is there's this whole other realm of what I call the social life, where it was very clear who was white and who wasn't white, and Mexican Americans in that context weren't white.
One of the things you do in the book is you quote an article from the New York Times that's in 1879, and it's about New Mexico statehood. And the title of the article is "Progress Retarded by a Want of Energy, Lazy Mexicans, the Chief Inhabitants." And I'll just want to read one sentence to mm-hmm. the audience. "The women, with the inevitable shawl about their head and muzzling their mouths, so that all one sees of them are the coal black eyes and tips of their tawny noses, go in bunches, and the men lag lazily behind them, with about as much care for their appearance as the average tramp." So that's in the New York Times. And if that's in the New York Times, I'm wondering what's being said behind closed doors.
Well, right. But what was said in other newspapers and of the day, right? This was not an exceptional view. This was the typical view, right? That Euro-Americans had about Mexicans. It was the view that they had before the war, during the war, and this is 1879, well after the American period of rule in New Mexico. And it's racism. It strikes us as so foreign, right? Because we don't hear that today, right? We live in a society where people don't believe those things oftentimes, and if they do, they certainly don't say them publicly, as you said. It's important to recognize that that was happening, and that there was a system of beliefs about Mexicans being racially inferior. And what I write about is well, then how did Mexicans respond? Because, you know, people respond to this context, right?
And there were a couple of
different responses. One is the response of elite Euro-Americans, some of whom went to the defense of Mexican-Americans in New Mexico. One of them was LeBaron Bradford Prince, who was later territorial governor. He had been initially come to New Mexico, as a territorial chief justice. He was interested in making New Mexico seem worthy of statehood for financial reasons and for political reasons. And he felt that if Mexican Americans were presumed to be racially inferior, that was never going to happen. So he started developing, in fact, he writes a letter, as you know, he writes a letter to the editor in response to that New York Times article and asserts the validity of what he calls the Spanish Americans of New Mexico. How did Mexican Americans react? Well, they ended up also embracing over time this Spanish American identity, claims to Spanish heritage, to the heritage of the conquistadores and so on. And that's That's really interesting. It wasn't kind of the pattern that we might have expected, but that's what happens.
Well, I want to talk about the claim to Spanish heritage and the claim to the conquistadores. But first, let me just mention that I'm speaking with Laura Gomez. She's a UNM professor. She's written a book called Manifest Destinies, and you're listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. And my name is Stephen Spitz. And one of the things you do is you analyze this claim to Spanish heritage in your book. And what does your analysis show?
Well, it shows that this is a myth rather than a reality. So oftentimes in the 20th century and today in the early 21st century, we hear New Mexicans talk about being Spanish.
And Hispano,
we hear that as well. But also, I mean, if Spanish. People are speaking in English, you know, we'll hear these claims. And you know, it's not just in New Mexico. You can hear it in New York, too, right? People. In fact, I was in New York over the weekend, and there was a Greek-American cab driver gave me a lift, and he was looking at me and asked where I was from and started talking, and he said, oh, yeah, so you're Spanish. And, you know, so it's not only here. But what I have attempted to do in this book is really very specifically in place and time historicize where this claim to Spanish identity comes from. And I think it comes very directly from that very strong racism that Mexican Americans were experiencing, even though they were in their homes in New Mexico and they had predated the Euro-Americans who had come to this region. And even though they had citizenship and voting rights under the new territorial government.
But I'd like to focus on what exactly the claim is. The claim is part of the claim is I can trace my origins to some of the first settlers mm-hmm. in New Mexico.
That's right.
Right. But then the rest of the claim is, and then that goes back to people in Spain. That ancestry then goes back to people in Spain.
Right. I mean, I guess I see.
And I guess what part of that is in the myth?
Right. Well. Sort of. To me, it's hard to separate out those two. But
okay.
For example, if we look at the early non-Indian settlements to this region,
okay.
Those people were already mixed people, right? They weren't people who came on a boat from Spain, went to Mexico, and then came straight up here. They were already Spaniards who had mixed with the indigenous people in Mexico and coming up here. For example, if you look at the Oñate party of 1598 coming in to settle New Mexico, many more Indians and mestizos, that is Indian Spanish mixed people, than Spaniards. So who is it that we're claiming if our family comes from those earliest families, right?
Well, one of the things I noticed in your book that I wasn't aware of was that after the Pueblo Revolt in 1680, what happened was all the Mexicans and Spanish went back to Mexico because they'd been defeated. And then you say the people who came back here were much less likely to have Spanish origins.
And that's, you know, I'm glad
here
you brought
New
that
Mexico.
Up, right, because we tend to, I think, often underestimate the tremendous change wrought by the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. So the Pueblos succeeded in kicking out everybody who was not sympathetic to them out of the region.
So it was a very successful revolt.
Very successful, right? People were murdered and then people were kicked out and it was only after those 12 years that the Pueblo said, well, we will renegotiate a resettlement under our terms. And if you think about it, you know, this really makes logical sense. Who's going to want to come back into the circumstance who was here before? They're kind of thinking, no, that's not really for me, right? And it's 12 years later, so they've made their lives in other places and so on. So the organizers of resettlement had to recruit into central and southern Mexico. And those people in particular in, you know, here we are at the end of the 1600s. They are recruiting a really diverse group of people who have very few ties to Spain, right, by this time.
So so part of the point is that people in New Mexico who can trace their origins back to the original settlers in New Mexico, they're not actually tracing their origins back to people who have an origin and an ancestry in Spain, but more likely an origin in central Mexico.
And in fact, let me just say a word about that because I should have probably said this earlier, Steve. But when we think about who those people in Mexico were, we have to recognize the population that Mexico had
All right, well,
in
what?
The colonial period. Mexico in the 1700s had the same number of African slaves as Spaniards. About 200,000 people in each of those categories.
So that's an astounding fact.
Right. People don't think about Mexico in that way.
You say, I think in the book, there are about 200,000 African Americans, about 200,000 Spaniards, and about 20 million indigenous people.
That's correct. And
so that mixture is not going to yield a predominantly Spanish person.
Exactly. Now, even if you sort of assume that people might have been picking their partners, their sexual or marital partners, according to phenotype or something like that, mm-hmm. they're not going to be able to do that to such a great extent, given those numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Mexican population is deeply mixed. You know, it's an interesting thing that if we're so willing to say that we're Spanish, why aren't we willing to say we're African, right, if we might be as have as much ancestry from Spain as from Africa.
Well, you seem to regard that as a racist point of view, an anti-Mexican point of view, this desire to tie to Spanish ancestry.
I do. I think that there's I mean, I think, and it's not that I'm, you know, I don't think this is, I'm not saying anything new in that regard of uh-huh. pointing to that as racist.
Well, I should point out you are a Mexican American.
That's right. And what's new is that I'm pulling together this material, right, and making mm-hmm. this argument. But if you go back to, let's say, the 1970s and think about the roots of the Chicano movement mm-hmm. and that era, one of the big ideas in that movement was, you know, we're indigenous people. We're not Europeans. We're not white. We're indigenous people. And we should, rather than be denying that and trying to cover it up, we should be embracing that. And this is sort of a continuation of that idea. We should embrace our racial mixture, our lack of purity, right? The kind of turning it on its head and saying there's nothing to be ashamed about in that mixture. That's just the way it is. And then part of it is also, you know, I mean, the U.S., whites in the U.S. and blacks in the U.S. are much more mixed than is generally acknowledged also.
Yeah, we see that with Richardson and Obama, don't we?
Right.
And, you know, another interesting thing I saw in the book about this subject was you looked at you've cited some DNA studies and some marriage records that I guess support your view of ancestry.
Yeah, the DNA research is new research looking at Southern Colorado and New Mexico. And what it tends to show, and I'm not going to be as articulate as I was in the footnote where I talk about this because it's not my field of scientific inquiry. But the general point is that if you look at people in that region, people who would call themselves Hispanic in Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico, the DNA research shows that they descend from people of European – with some European parental paternal lineage and indigenous maternal lineage. And that makes sense given the story, right? Thinking
it
about
certainly does.
The pattern of moving up from Mexico to New Mexico.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. My guest today is Laura Gomez, who's written a book called Manifest Destinies about the history of Mexican Americans in the United States and in New Mexico. My name is Stephen Spitz. And I want to turn to the other really explosive issue in your book, which is the question of Indian slavery and the holding of Indian slaves in New Mexico. And one of the things that happens in New Mexico is the territory decides to become a slave territory. And the conventional explanation for that is the people thought that would be advantageous in terms of becoming a state more quickly. That turned out not to be the case, right? New Mexico was one of the last, not the last, part of the cessation territories to become a state. But you say that another part of it that isn't talked a lot about was the holding of Indian slaves in New Mexico. I wonder if you can talk to us
about that.
Well,
I think there were actually a number of things going on. I do think that the statehood – now, we're talking about 1857 here.
All right.
And you're right that very much we're – so in 1850, New Mexico has become a federal territory. And from that moment on, people in New Mexico are saying, we don't want to be a territory. We want to be a state. That's where the action is, right? And that's mm-hmm. going to be advantageous in all sorts of ways. But New Mexico doesn't become a state until 1912. In 1857, I think there are a number of dynamics. I'd say there are three pieces of that puzzle. One is, yes, the statehood. Maybe because the Democrats are in power in Congress, if we say that we're pro-slavery, maybe we can become a state, right?
Mm-hmm.
The second is a very...
Well, there's this sort of balancing of slave states and non-slave
states. That's right, as new states come in, right?
And they thought it was advantageous to come in as a slave state sooner. You might get in sooner.
The other thing that's going on there is in 1856, the Supreme Court decides the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott is a decision which the Supreme Court says blacks, whether they are free or enslaved, have absolutely no citizenship in the United States. They basically are people without rights. We don't recognize them as citizens. And this is a very radical decision at the time. Many people credit that decision as being one of the catalysts for the Civil War. But think about that dichotomy there. The Supreme Court is saying even free blacks like Frederick Douglass don't have federal citizenship, and yet Mexican Americans in New Mexico have federal citizenship, right?
That's right.
And so I think part of what was going on here was a distancing, a social distancing. So you have the Mexican American legislators in the territorial legislature saying, we want to affirm this idea. We're very different from those blacks, even those free blacks. And so we're gonna pass this legislation to say we're a slave state, even though before we had said we wanted to be a free state.
And I should mention also that there are very few, I think, African Americans in New Mexico.
Very few. So it's almost all about symbolic politics.
I think you say something like 22
at
the time.
Yeah, that's right.
22 people
right,
in the entire
territory.
New Mexico territory, right.
Which included Arizona at the time,
right?
Right. Okay. And then the third factor is the one that you started us out with, which I think is really important and oftentimes something people don't recognize, which is that Mexican Americans and also some Euro-Americans in New Mexico owned Indian slaves. And primarily these were peoples captured in war or sold in raids from the nomadic tribes, Navajo, Apache, Comanche, and then are sold as slaves into families. And so part of the agenda was, I think, about protecting their property in slaves, right, in this way. Now, interestingly, though, when the Civil War breaks out, New Mexico's territorial legislature doesn't side with the Confederacy, right? So you know, it's a complicated story. It's not, mm-hmm. My idea is to kind of flesh out the historical record so that we know that it's a more complicated story rather than kind of just assuming that we know what people were thinking at the time.
Now, so some percentage of the Indian slaves come from nomadic Indians tribes that you mentioned who capture other Indians in battle. What do you have any idea what percentage?
Well, I think probably almost all of them. In other words, they were not Pueblo Indians who were enslaved.
Yes.
They were from these other tribes in the region. Is that your question, Steve?
Well, I also thought that Mexican Americans were selling slaves to other Mexican Americans.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Yeah, so, but all of the slaves that they were selling were from these other tribes. So
I
people
see.
Would just acquire them in different ways. So they would be acquired by.
I mean, this was actual
raiding parties,
like blacks. People were bought and sold.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to reduce it to this was just like chattel slavery in the South,
uh-huh.
but I think it was similar enough that we should call it slavery, even though that makes us uncomfortable, or
mm-hmm.
maybe because that makes us uncomfortable. So it wasn't that there were auction houses in New Mexico where you could go and buy slaves the way that you could mm-hmm. in Alabama and South Carolina and you know, inspect your property before you bought it. It was more of an informal economy, and it had, by the way, been the economy of this region for about three centuries before this as well.
So did Indian Pueblo people also have slaves?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I would probably guess that some did. Certainly, some might have been involved in the sale of people, but I don't know the answer to that question, because what we know about the people who owned slaves is really from the records left behind by people who were sent from Washington to put a stop to what was sometimes in polite company called peonage, and they were going for Euro-Americans and Mexican-Americans in towns in northern New Mexico and sort of lining people up to say, you know, we allege that you have these slaves in your house. They weren't going to Pueblos.
I see. So this occurs like in 1862, there's the Emancipation Proclamation. And then there's a specific proclamation with regard to Indian slavery, correct?
That's right, as well as the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which is ratified in 1865, which says there shall be no slavery or involuntary servitude. That was thought to the proclamation on Indian peonage is also in 1865.
So how common was Indian slavery in New Mexico?
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell because we don't have census records for that people have looked at in detail in every place to tell us house by house. But, for example, if we look at particular places like I'm trying to recollect a study that was done in the Taos area, and if memory serves me right, the research that I quote from that in the book is that something like 15% of households had one or more slaves, you know.
And how were the slaves used the same way that slaves were used in the South?
No, and that's an important point. Also, there wasn't a plantation economy. They weren't used in agricultural labor so much as used as household labor. And one of the other elements of that kind of goes back to our earlier conversation is because they were in the house, there was actually more social and sexual mingling between those folks as well, right? These people who were Indian slaves and then who over time become part of the Hispanic community over generations.
You know, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to sort of turn the discussion to the future, having talked about these disparate groups. And one of the things that struck me is that, you know, since 1850, there's been a lot of immigration in the United States, a lot of white ethnics of immigrants, you know, Jews, Italian, Poles, Germans, you know, a lot of people. Meanwhile, the original inhabitants of New Mexico, Mexicans and Indians, are still kind of regarded as the other in our society. I'm wondering how you see the future going. Do you see trend lines? Where do you see... Mm-hmm. Our culture going, the Basque culture and the Mexican and Indian culture going, mm-hmm. In the next 20 years, 10 to 20 years?
Well, so I mentioned the statistic earlier in our conversation, but I want to just emphasize it. Within 40 years, Latinos in the United States are going to be 30% of the national population. And we're going to be at a point then with the Asian and the Black population, the Native American population, that we're going to be getting close to minorities, quote unquote, making up close to half the U.S. population. And that's going to be a really different scene than mm-hmm. where we are right now. On the other hand, several states are leading the way in that, right? New Mexico has been a majority minority state, so-called, because most of its residents are from traditionally underrepresented minorities mm-hmm. from the beginning. So has Hawaii, right? California and Texas were recently added to that list. So I think if we want to think about where things are going, those are the states that we need to look at. And I think there's sort of two basic models. We could look at where California has been. California has really been the bellwether for the most extreme reactions to immigration and to racial increasing minority populations. For example, think about Proposition 209, which banned affirmative action in California. Think about Prop 187, which was a very harsh response to immigration. That's not been that, and those things have largely been held up by courts or not really followed.
Next 20 seconds we have left. So where do you see that heading?
New Mexico is a much better model, I think, right? An alternative where actually we've had a majority minority population, but it hasn't meant that this new minority majority is oppressing the whites, right? It's been a system of cooperation and working together, and I think recognizing the needs for social justice for everyone.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my guest today, Laura Gomez, UNM Law Professor. Her book, Manifest Destinies, is out in paperback. I would also like to thank my engineer, Sam Irons. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, Ideas on KUNM 89.9.